All right, this is take two, side A. We were talking about the transition from graduate work to postdoc and how you got eventually to the University of Oregon. Describe the Weston lab. You already mentioned that there was a lot of interaction, a lot more than in the earlier lab. But what was his mentoring style? How did he handle his students or his postdocs?
Jim's mentoring style was to stay in his office and talk to us when we had a paper to write or he had a grant to write.
Really? So hands off, fairly. Yeah.
We would have lab meeting once a week, and his only meaningful contributions would be he would force us to start our talks with what we're interested in so that we weren't too diving into the technical.
Mm-hmm.
So he was very interested in style, and I think he assumed we would solve our experiments one way or another.
Right. And how big was that lab?
When I was there, I caught up to 6 postdocs and 1 student.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, I should have asked this earlier. How big was the Byers lab when you ran it?
At one point, it had as many as 4 students and 3 or 4 postdocs.
Mm-hmm. And did you continue to come in at 8:30? Do you have pretty much the same routine in the Weston lab that you had in the Byers?
No. So, one thing I've learned is that where the postdocs and graduate students of a cohort, like we were in Eugene, can be really great, the technicians can be really awful.
Mm-hmm.
And these are people I do dearly love, but by awful I mean awfully stuck in their ways. So they had ways of breeding fish that I just quickly found were too slow. I had to, because I wasn't, the big fish facility there really was Chuck Kimmel's facility. And they found space for me, and then I built my own facility. So when we started procedures in the main facility, the fish would wake up at 9:30. That's just crazy. So I, except for the breeding procedures that required extra equipment, like the half tetrad, the early pressure parthenogenesis, or heat shock, I would do all my breeding up in my own facility. I had a desk where I could sit and I could squeeze my fish, and then I set my clock to 8 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
So I was there when the fish were there, and I probably bred fish, 5 days a week for the first 5 years.
That's amazing. In reading some of the letters of recommendation that were sent in the Pew, I mean, they mentioned, for instance, the risk involved, first of all, in setting up the system, and some of them were very suitable, were very impressed with that effort, too. But part of that also was because you had, was partly because of the funding, too, that you felt you had time, therefore, to set this up and to...
I think that I was naive. It was probably a bad decision.
Right.
I probably should have focused earlier on some discrete questions.
Right.
And I didn't get pushed that way by Jim Weston, but I did get pushed that way by Chuck Kimmel.
Right.
And he strongly encouraged me to look at pigment pattern.
Right. Talk a little bit about Chuck Kimmel then. And what was it like working with him?
So Chuck is absolutely great. He is amazing. He knows no molecular biology, and I mean, he picks up what he needs a little bit, and I don't think he cares.
Mm-hmm.
What he's really interested in what cells do, and he knows how to, he has an intuitive understanding of how to use genetics. He doesn't have the formal rigor that Lee Hartwell had, but he understands the formal rigor. But he also understands that it's not that we don't study genes. We study what happens when genes don't work, mm-hmm. to understand what cells are doing. And that's really what he is so amazing for. And he's got, and that he picked up later in his career. Initially, he picked up just how to do morphology of development. Mm-hmm. Okay, now for me, coming from a yeast genetics background, where, you know, what a cell is doing is just, it's growing or not growing, but it doesn't go from here to there and then play ball with these guys. So. Mm-hmm. And in our current generation, many developmental biologists don't actually think about the complex nature of the organism, that it's a lot of cells that have to coordinate. And as they're coordinating, they're doing a lot of amazing things. Mm-hmm. So Chuck is, I think, the best morphologist in the business, and he's really accessible with people. He can look at your data and come up with ideas, and then you go, wow, I can come up with ideas like that too, because it's fun when you hear them. Mm-hmm. So yeah, he leads with his incredible imagination. Mm-hmm. Hmm. And he can actually put down the law, too. When I joined Eugene, he was not in Eugene. He was on sabbatical. And when he came back, he heard people saying, oh, Steve Johnson wants to mutagenize with ethyl nitrosic urea. No one does that. And everyone's scared. Mm-hmm. And I suppose they should respect it. But, you know, he sat down and talked to me, and he said, well, I understand that you want to do all these things, and that's great, but you have to work with my people.
Right.
Or I'll have to ask you to go.
Right. Give us an overview of the research that you did for your postdoc, then. Now here we do have many articles. Now here we do have articles.
Yes, so here I knew I had to publish.
Right.
I worked on, I guess I'd say, four different ideas, apart from that one that we discussed that just didn't work. One was, okay, just how does a tissue regenerate? So if you cut off a fin, it regenerates. And one way to study that is to find mutants that don't regenerate, mm-hmm. and try to figure those out. And I found some mutants, and we made a little bit of progress on those. And that's actually only, well, one of those mutants is now becoming interesting, but only recently. Mm-hmm. So that was the most of the work that I probably did there. So it was the least productive for the time. Mm-hmm. I picked up working on pigment pattern because as I was cutting off all these fins, I noticed that they regenerated the stripes in the fins too. There was some very ancient literature that suggested it was very precise and I could replicate that. And then I found one of the mutants that Streisinger had found many years ago that I just happened to have in my hands for mm-hmm. some reason. I don't remember why I had it. When I amputated and asked it to regenerate its pigment pattern, it did it in a remarkably weird way. It didn't make cells when I thought it should. Mm-hmm. And then I've been pursuing, that's the major part of our biological program, is understanding the insights into melanocyte stem cell biology that first observation was suggesting. Mm-hmm. That's one. I started working on, and we have made no major insights into, just because I was working on melanocytes, I picked up stripes, why stripes are this far apart instead of this far apart, or why there's stripes instead of spots. Mm-hmm. And we're still trying to clone those genes. Another thing that I started working on as a postdoc was the notion of isometric growth control. And this is the type of project that I just did because it was easy to generate a little bit of data. And then both Jim Weston and Chuck Kimmel strongly encouraged me that it was fundamentally interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And that is why when fish grow, do they grow proportionately, isometrically? And that is when they grow everywhere at the same time. And yet we have mutants that overgrow their fins.
Mm-hmm.
So we made some I made some progress there, but I don't think I ever published any of it. And then about half of my lab works on that project now.
Right.
And we're having a lot of fun with that.
Good. And we'll talk about that too.
Okay.
Your current research. We'll bring it up to date.
And then I worked on developing the map, the
right.
genomic resources.
Mm-hmm. And what was that like? I mean, we've just recently seen sort of the carnival surrounding the human genome and sort of the race, you know, in terms of money, personalities, you know what I'm talking about. Talk a little bit about the effort to create this genome for the zebrafish. I mean, what was the project? How was it set up? Who oversaw it?
Yeah, I guess it is a carnival. it's sort of amazing how this is genomics is what brings out the worst in scientists, I think.
Really?
When I moved to Eugene, my understanding with Jim Weston and Monty Westerfeld was that one of the things I was going to work on was how to develop maps for zebrafish. Clearly, we needed genetic maps to organize our data and eventually get us to cloning our genes. At that time, other people were toying with other ways of doing it, which turned out to be better, and thank God they did it. For instance, Mark Fishman had hired people to use these methods of SSLPs, simple sequence length polymorphisms.
Mm-hmm.
CA repeats to develop maps. But at the time, shortly after I got to Eugene, John Postlewaite had an undergraduate student who showed that you could use a random oligotenmer. This was first showed in plants by other people, but then we found we could do it in zebrafish.
Mm-hmm.
And get bands, and if you looked at a haploid cross, so that's really easy to look at because you have this from your diploid parent, you have this allele or that allele,
mm-hmm.
but not both. You could see that they were segregating. They had this one or that one. And if that was the case, it would be a very cheap way of developing maps. So I looked at that and saw that I thought the data would be good. And convinced Jim and Chuck to spend their money on this program in Eugene instead of donating some money to this project that was going on in Boston.
Right.
And so then we developed that.
Mm-hmm. And, I mean, what was your role in that, other than, of course, sort of setting the ball, helping to set the ball rolling?
When they had a whole bunch of data and didn't know how to analyze it, I sat down with the data and turned it into a map.
Oh, okay.
And that was the first map, which was actually useless because it wasn't based on inbred strains, and most of the markers were not reproducible from fish to fish. But that was a science paper, go figure. And then I was able to use that to map the first mutants in zebrafish too.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't completely irreproducible, but largely. From doing that, I learned there were things that I wanted to figure out how to do. I wanted to figure out how to use centromere markers for mapping,
mm-hmm.
and I wanted to do it reproducibly, so I needed inbred strains. So I developed inbred strains, and then I repeated the map on inbred strains and mapped the centromeres, and then developed the way of mapping with centromere markers that we now use.
Right. Okay. I'm a novice at this. What's the advantage of using a centromere marker?
Oh, okay. Let's see if I can do it without drawings.
Okay.
You know, in meiosis, there are four, well, in a diploid cell, there are two chromosomes, one that you got from mom and one you got from dad.
Right.
And in meiosis, those are duplicated, so you have two of mom and two of dad. So those are the four chromosomes, and that's what we would call the tetrad. Mm-hmm. And later on, when they form the gametes, you have the four products of meiosis, each have one of those chromosomes. Mm-hmm. In female meiosis, for instance, typically only one of those turns into the egg and the other three are destroyed. Okay?
Okay.
What happens then, at the four-strand stage, you get crossover and recombination.
Mm-hmm.
But then they're segregated at this, by tugging, the cell apparatus tugs at the centromeres. Okay, so if you have crossover, it will give crossover distal of the centromere, but the centromere, mom's centromeres are pulled in one direction and dad's in the others because you can't have crossover between the attachment site mm-hmm. and itself, okay?
Right.
So that's the first meiotic division, and then the second meiotic division, which we call equational, segregates those from each other, and then that becomes the gamete, mm-hmm. okay? In what we call, in zebrafish, early pressure parthenogenesis, we let this occur. That is, that's what the fish does for us before we can get the egg, and they're arrested at that. And when we add the sperm, it proceeds to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And it does that in the first 6 minutes. We can cause it to fail to do that by putting it under very high pressure. And then,
by the way, when you said this, you separated your finger.
The right. second division. Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
We can prevent the second division with high pressure in the first 6 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And then it'll package one half of that first division as the female pronucleus, as the gamete.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Now, that's got to be homozygous at the centromere. All right?
I think I'm following you.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, let's say you have a mutation. Let's say it's a mutant that makes the melanocytes pale instead of dark.
Mm-hmm.
And let's say it's way out here. So there's going to be a large probability of getting a crossover. So if you looked at any individual chromosome, it's likely that it's recombinant between the centromere and that mutation.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? But now we're going to look at our half tetrads, our parthenogenetic embryos. They're homozygous at all their centromeres, and a small fraction, somewhere between 5% and 50%, depending on how far this mutant is from its centromere, mm-hmm. will be homozygous at that mutant location. That is, they have two copies of the mutation.
Right.
Okay, most of the time, the majority will be heterozygous for the mutation because there's been a crossover. Not strictly a majority, but oftentimes we find the majority of the half tetrads mm-hmm. have one crossover, so they're heterozygous. And then some others are no crossovers, but they're homozygous wild type.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to ignore those. We're going to only pay attention to the ones that are homozygous mutants. So homozygous at the centromere, homozygous at the mutant locus. We can, but it's a complicated event, have crossovers have occurred between the centromere and our mutant.
Mm-hmm.
So now, essentially, no matter how far away we are, no matter how, on average, how often we'll get crossovers between these, we can ignore them. We've taken a statistical subset, but we know which subset to use.
Mm-hmm.
It's non-recombinant. And now instead of having to screen an enormous number of markers to find out what chromosome this is on, we just use one marker per centromere.
Mm-hmm. I see.
Okay.
Okay. I'll play this over again so I get all the other... I'll understand it better, but yeah, it seems to make sense.
Okay. So okay.
That was
the I think... Well, George, this was a trivial result from classic tetrad analysis, and people could have told us this in the 30s.
Mm-hmm.
We just didn't understand it. George Streisinger understood it, but he didn't tell it to us. After he died, Chuck Kimmel Naira Herskowitz wrote his manuscript, but it didn't actually say this. Because I didn't get it out of that manuscript. I didn't get it until the fish showed it to me.
So it had to be rediscovered, more or less.
Yeah, or reintuited.
Reintuited, yeah.
I should have known this as a yeast geneticist, but I didn't. And all the yeast geneticists, when I had them read the paper for me before submitting it, they all go, well, you know this is trivial. And I go, I know it's trivial. I can't believe I'm just now understanding it. But it was a very important, maybe it was most important in that I could figured out how to explain it.
Right. All right, so you help out, I mean, you play an important part then in the mapping of the zebrafish genome. Are we forgetting any other important development? You've already mentioned four projects, and a couple of those obviously you carry over into your PI work as well. At the end of your postdoc, you eventually end up at the University of Washington, as you know.
Washington University.
Washington University, I'm sorry. Yeah. And how do you get there? Why there rather than another place?
So I mostly applied for jobs blind. I was invited to apply to one place that was looking for a melanocyte worker, but mostly advertisements. Zebrafish was just starting to take off. A lot of people thought maybe they need a zebrafish worker. I got a lot of interviews. I got two and would have had three, but I ended the search job offers. And of those, I went to Washington University because I didn't really want to teach undergraduates of the, so between the biology department at Michigan, where I probably would have had to do a lot of teaching. And in the med school, my teaching responsibilities virtually nothing. I do lots of one-on-one mentoring, but very little organized teaching. It wasn't clear that Michigan could have come up with the fish facility I wanted, and it was clear that Washington University could do what they said they would give me, because I knew they had the money. In their, you know, it was the genome guy, right. Paul Broderston. If he says he can do it, I knew he could do it.
And what was the startup package at Washington University, other than having, you know, the sort of the mechanism in place to produce zebrafish?
What was the second startup package? Like, how much money did I get?
Yes. Yeah,
what guarantee of my salary?
Yeah.
I don't know what guarantee of my salary. Essentially, my salary was and is guaranteed whether I bring anything in, because everybody in the med school salary is guaranteed. Though after you have tenure and you don't continue to produce, they'll start to cut it back.
Right.
But they can't and won't fire you for that. I was given $300,000, which was a lot, but not outrageous at the time, for the lab, and then another, gosh, how much did it cost? I think it cost $200,000 or a little more than that, $240,000 to set up the fish facility.
And what was the hardest part about setting up your lab?
Setting up the fish facility.
Right. How long did that take?
About 6 years.
Oh my God.
I would argue we're not done. The water in St. Louis is different than the water in Eugene. I tried to replicate what I was doing in Eugene, but it wouldn't work. And after about 4 years, we tore it all apart and replaced it with stuff that other people were using very successfully, some commercial stuff that's now available, and we're now learning how to use that.
Okay. So a very long, difficult process.
But before I had fish, it took about 9 months.
Yeah. Okay. You've already mentioned a little bit about the research that you carried over to your position at Washington University. But tell us a little bit about your current research, and again in terms, and you've done really well so far, I want to compliment you on that, but in terms, again, that a non-scientist can understand, how have you sort of extended this project that you've already mentioned?
Okay. Let's do genomics, because that's the easiest to explain.
Okay.
The NIH has decided that it really wants zebrafish to be an important model system. Mm-hmm. And therefore, they decided about 6 years ago to begin to develop the infrastructure for zebrafish genetics and genomics. I took advantage of being at Washington University with its amazing genome center to propose to do everything they wanted done. They decided not to let me do everything, mm-hmm. or not to give me money for everything. I had proposed to identify all the genes, map many of them, find single nucleotide polymorphisms on those mm-hmm. between my inbred strains. And I guess that was that initial proposal. Then I was asking them to let us build the physical map mm-hmm. from bat clones. And then they gave me money to find most of the genes, and then over the next few years, as we didn't have enough money to do all the gene discovery we wanted, they continued to give us money to do more gene discovery. That is the EST project, expressed sequence tag. That's where you take a cDNA mm-hmm. and you sequence a little bit of each end, and that gives you an identifier. Okay,
right.
And oftentimes that's enough to even tell you what the gene is, comparing it to human or mouse or fruit flies. Hmm. So we've been very successful at that. And then they gave us some money to map genes. That is, radiation hybrid mapping panels had been developed, two of them. And we took our ESTs, designed primers for them, and then type them on our radiation hybrid panels. So we did that both ourselves, and then we coordinated several other labs. So in order to limit redundancy, we did the gene distribution. We said, you guys are doing these and you guys are doing those.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. In part to limit redundancy, we needed to find, when we've got a tag, is that tag an independent gene or is it just an old gene? So that we don't sequence the same gene over and over and map the same gene over and over and over again. So we've been developing informatics in my lab to cluster the genes together where they have direct overlap, mm-hmm. or when they are from the different ends of the same cDNA, associate them. And that sounds really trivial, but it's not, because oftentimes there are errors in when they may be associated. So then we've developed techniques to find when there are probably errors in the data submission so that we don't associate them.
Right.
So we're just wrapping this part of the project up, and we found 25 to 26,000 genes, which is about right.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sort of guessing of our predicted genes, about 4,000 or 5,000 of them are actually cloning artifacts,
mm-hmm.
and then the others are real genes. And we've got, I think, 7,000 of those mapped. We've been able to draw, I think, fairly significant insights into the relationship of the zebrafish and human genome. For instance, when we were going into this project, we thought there'd be really big stretches between zebrafish and human that were unrearranged.
Right.
And we're now finding that, from our mapping data, that it's probably, the stretches are quite small, 2 or 3 or 4 genes, and then there's a rearrangement breakpoint.
Hmm.
So evolution has really scrambled these genomes.
Mm-hmm.
That's leading me to think that the next projects that I want to do aren't data generation. I'm sort of tired of that. But now that we've got all this data, we can ask if there's a breakpoint every 3 or 4 genes, is that actually generating new genes? If you break a gene in the middle mm-hmm. and recombine it with another gene broken in the middle, you've got a kinetic gene. So now I think we have enough data in zebrafish to ask, is that playing a significant role in the evolution? We can't ask this functionally, but we can ask, how many can we find?
Right.
Or similarly, is the evolution could not be because you're making new genes, but you're changing promoters, the part of the upstream that causes it to be regulated.
Right.
So can we begin to come up with ways to identify when the promoter is chimeric and shows expression characteristics of two ancestral genes?
Mm-hmm.
So that's sort of where I want to take that. One of the places I want to take that. So we're sort of done with this massive production of data. The Sanger Center is going to do the sequencing.
Mm-hmm.
Thank goodness, or I would have gotten dragged into that. And that really would have killed my biology career.
Right. And the mapping. The mapping's a third done then.
Of the genes, a third of them are done. But what the important thing about that isn't that the genes are mapped.
Mm-hmm.
It's that we now have places on the map that as we get genome sequence, we can anchor them to our map.
Right.
So as the Sanger Center generates data, they know where they fall. And then they can do more targeted experiments to try to link up the things that we think map together.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So you're, in a sense, the coordinator of all these efforts, then?
Well, no, I'm not the coordinator of the Sanger effort.
Right.
I'm just providing a resource that they will use.
Right.
They speak such a different language that I can't coordinate what they do.
Right. Okay, so there's this effort, and then what other undertakings do you have in your lab?
We are... So this initial observation of when you cut off a fin in a sparse mutant, it doesn't make melanocytes, we are following that up in a lot of different ways. One, we made temperature-sensitive alleles of c-kit. The gene was a gene called c-kit. It's an old famous mutant from mouse, also called dominant spotting. It's a receptor tyrosine kinase. In mouse... if mice are mutant for this, they grow up without any melanocytes. And we think, in the literature, we think that they don't have melanocytes because they don't make their... They make their stem cells, but they die in the embryo.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So if you don't have your stem cells and your hair falls out and you make a new hair, but you don't have a stem cell for it, then it does this. It's gray.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And then that mouse is all white because it lost its stem cells in the embryo. That's the mouse notion.
Okay.
So we decided to test that in the zebrafish by asking if we made a temperature-sensitive allele of kit. That is one that grows normally at a low temperature but without gene function at the high temperature. Could we use that to ask, is it acting early or late?
Mm-hmm.
And we made the allele, we made several alleles, and we showed that it acts late, after amputation, in the process of recruiting stem cells back into development. It has no role early in establishing the stem cell lineage.
Mm-hmm.
So that was nice. That's making us, and I hope others, rethink this mouse result. There are a lot of things that are hard to resolve still. But that was a fun result. Now, the next step is when these sparse or kit-dependent melanocytes don't develop, well, that's not the whole story. They wait about a week, and then other melanocytes develop.
Mm-hmm.
So we call those secondary regeneration melanocytes. And these are really interesting melanocytes that are going to tell us a lot about how tissue integrity is maintained, because you want to know, I know you want to know this, why do you continue to have blood? is your blood cells are dying all the time, yet you keep having blood. So somebody's paying attention in there.
Right.
Or why, if you nick yourself, does that heal right? Something's paying attention, knows the right form mm-hmm. or tissue and makes it. And we think that's the job of the stem cells, that they're actively surveilling their environment and saying, oh, there's a problem here, we're going to make new cells.
Right.
For instance, in this KIT mutant, when it doesn't make these melanocytes, after a week, new melanocytes are made. But instead of now, new melanocytes are always being made in the distalmost growing part of the regenerating fin.
Right.
And this is all a regeneration experiment. But in the KIT mutant, when it begins to make melanocytes, it's making them in a very old part of the regenerate, a week older than where they're typically being made.
Mm-hmm.
So it's making them in the wrong place. That is, after a week delay. We know if we look at a wild type fish, they're just not being made there. Very, very few are being made there. However, we can do experiments to reveal some role for late cells. We can look for holes in the stripe. These stem cells have ideas that they're surveying the environment for defects mm-hmm. in the tissue that they're responsible for. So we looked for holes, did lineage experiments to see how those holes are fixed. And in fact, they're fixed from new cells, not from old cells.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's confirming our notion. So we want to know, how do those cells survey their environment? And this is a great opportunity for it.
What's the feedback loop?
What's the feedback loop?
Yeah.
So we did a mutant screen, and in fact, when we did a mutant screen, we didn't get mutants in the feedback loop.
Mm-hmm.
We got mutants in the first part, which is presumably when we amputate, a stem cell is recruited to divide.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all this is inferential. We've got only the briefest glimpse of a stem cell after it's divided.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't seen a stem cell. This is sort of like nuclear physics before they've seen
right.
neutrons, but they're inferring them, okay, or whatever particles that they're still only inferring. But we want to see those cells. But we can still do these experiments to make inferences on those stem cells. So we think you cut them, the stem cells recruited to make new cells, it then allocates some of the cells to become to remain as stem cells, and it allocates others to immediately differentiate as a melanocyte.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. When we looked for mutants that didn't make this regulatory population in a KIT mutant background, so we're looking for double mutants that don't make it, and then we add back that first gene KIT, we found something really striking, and that is it now makes way too many of that first population of melanocytes.
Mm-hmm.
So that suggests to us that in this allocation problem, it's allocating most of its daughters to make melanocytes and very few as stem cells.
Right.
So that's going to be a fundamental insight into how stem cells are maintained mm-hmm. so that you can continue to have blood mm-hmm. or skin or all these other parts of your body that are maintained
right.
by stem cell populations.
That's fascinating.
Yeah. It is.
All right. What are the sort of long and or short-term applications for your work? I mean, obviously one of them, you know, is clotting and whatnot, but expand a little bit on that, if you would.
Well,
both real and potential.
The short-term application of our genomics work is it will let people clone their genes more rapidly.
Right.
That's a very fundamental technical problem, advance. Our work on melanocyte stem cells is going to give us insights into how stem cells behave in mm-hmm. the adult organism. Because even in us and in mice, the adult stem cell is something that we don't really have a solid handle on.
Right.
So we're going to get insights into that. And if we begin to get insights, we'll be able to learn how to manipulate them.
Okay. Any others?
When we clone lungfin, we're going to be able to introduce it into other fish and make them equally pretty. The real answer is, this is part of the proportionate growth thing, we're going to begin to understand what the growth control mechanisms are systemic in the body and local in the tissue that are coordinating growth. Some of our overgrowth mutants, if I starved you, you'd quit growing, right? But if you had a tumor and I starved you, your tumor would continue to grow, okay? Mm-hmm. If I cut off your fin would regenerate even though you were starving. So this is a fundamental problem of nutritional, we call it nutritional surveillance.
Right.
How do tissues pay attention to the nutritional status of the individual and decide to grow or not grow? Tumors lack much of this. Regenerating fins or limbs in animals that do that bypass this. We have mutants, overgrowth mutants, not regeneration mutants, some of which pay attention to nutritional surveillance and others bypass it.
Right.
So we think we're going to start to get some of a fundamental understanding of nutritional surveillance, and maybe that'll tell us something about cancer.
Right.
I'd be surprised if it didn't.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, we're almost at 5, and we're near the end of this tape, so this might be a good place to stop
today.
Okay.
Oh, okay.